Well, Britt, thanks for joining me. It's good to talk to you, and I've enjoyed your record a lot.
Thank you so much, and thank y'all for playing it. This record's been a long time in the making, and I'm just so excited that everybody's finally getting to hear it.
I guess I'd want to start with background because it does, everything leads to what this music sounds like now. And you mentioned that you grew up in a real remote part of Kentucky, and in your bio, it's you tie it to the country music highway and the lineage, the storied history of Kentucky artists that have made country music so rich over the last 50 years or more. So what was the geography like?
Yeah, so I grew up real close to Highway US 23, which it's really lucky, and it seems very meant to be, because none of my immediate family plays any type of instruments. They don't sing. It's not something that's valued, really. They turn it on when they're in the car sometimes. But because I grew up in that area, they really foster a love for country music and for bluegrass music. So there's a lot of opportunities to perform and get involved in learning how to play instruments, because the culture is just so rich in it. So because of that, I got involved at an early age in a tourist show called the Kentucky Opry Junior Pros. I was a kid, so I was in the kids group. And just got to learn to sing and play, and I just feel so lucky for being able to grow up in that area, because had I not grown up in an area with such a culture for country music, I don't know if I would have wound up here.
Do you remember an individual who said, here's what these chords are, here's how to listen to a melody, here's a great song, and why it's a great song? Is there, who were the mentors?
Yeah, I had a fantastic vocal coach named Chris Lafferty. He's actually out in Murfreesboro now. I think he's a school teacher or a principal. And he would always help me pick my songs for the show. And so I'd come in with a group of songs, and he would always explain to me, why Trish Yearwood had such great songs and why she was such a great singer, and Patti Loveless. And then, he'd explain to me why I couldn't sing this song because I was too young or it didn't fit. And he just really taught me to evaluate these songs and to really listen. And he taught me chords. He taught me the Nashville number system when I was really young. Still not that great at that, but definitely give a lot of credit to Chris.
And where and what is the Kentucky Opry?
So it's a tourist group. It's kind of like something you would see in Branson. We performed every weekend of the summer season, like every Friday night through June and July. And then we would do a Christmas season from Thanksgiving to Christmas. And it was at the Mountain Arts Center in Prestonsburg, Kentucky. That's where they held their shows. And I also got to see a lot of my first concerts there. I got to see Ricky Skaggs, Brad Paisley. I think my first concert was George Jones with my papaw, because it was him and me that liked country music. So here I was, in high school taking my papaw to these concerts because none of the kids wanted to go see George Jones.
Nice. Good claim to fame. When did Nashville begin to look like a realistic place? Was it college that said, I can go and study and be there and do the next step of my life, that everybody will be like, yes, that makes sense?
Yeah, when I was really young and playing in the Opry, I think I was like in sixth grade, they actually selected 13 of us to come to Nashville and play for some members of the US 23 Highway. So we got a charter bus that said Kentucky Opry on the side of it, and I just thought I was big stuff, buddy, getting to come to Nashville. It was my first trip. And Ricky Skaggs was there, Dwight Yoakam was there, I think Montgomery Gentry, Billy Ray Cyrus, I don't think Loretta Lynn made it. I think Rebecca Lynn Howard might have been there, but a lot of those Kentucky artists were there, and they came to Merchants downtown to watch this group of kids, and it was supposed to be, these are the next US 23 artists.
I see.
Yeah, so that was really the first moment of getting to come to Nashville and being like, oh, so this is where this happens. This is where I got to come to.
And then did you come for, I think you got a college degree in Nashville, or at least attended?
Yes, that was my way to town. I was like, yeah, I have to learn about this. I don't know anything about music business. So I graduated high school when I was 17. I was really young and came to MTSU and got my degree and started writing songs as soon as I got here.
You got a publishing deal, and it looked like you had things kind of, you had a flow and you had a direction, you had a trajectory. Tell me about the early writing you did and what you learned and what was intimidating and what was awesome and unexpected about the songwriting side, because it sounds like you were making more headway on as a writer than as an artist in those early Nashville years.
Yeah, so I think in school I learned that a way to a record deal was you find a manager or you find a publisher first or a producer. And I was like, okay, one of those three things. I have to find one of those three things. And it just so happened that I was already writing a lot. And actually, a teacher, Hal Newman at MTSU, I had taken his class and he was like, "Why aren't you majoring in songwriting?" And I was like, "Well, because I already know how to write a song. I don't know anything about the business, though. I need to learn about that." And he actually helped me get an internship that was half business and half writing at Cal4, which is now Spirit Music. So I actually got a deal a few years after that internship ended.
Who was coming and going through that office? Who were the writers and who were the artists that were being trafficked? And what did you see from that point of view as a young person?
Eric Paisley was the big one I was watching because he had just came from MTSU and he had an internship at Cal4 and then he got signed to this record deal and I was like, oh man, if I can just do what Eric Paisley's doing, then I'll be in good shape. And Jim Collins was there. Oh my gosh, I just started writing with so many people, Marcus Hummond. It was really, really a great experience and I just wouldn't take it back for nothing.
How did you approach crafting and getting inhabiting your own voice? Because the singing on this record is absolutely gorgeous. It has classic country tones, but I can tell it's you, and it's a great asset. And I wonder if you felt like that was an effortless gift, or if you've spent time thinking about how you'd draw out the best qualities that you're born with.
Man, I have to give credit to Dan Auerbach and Dave Brainerd on that. I always thought that it was an effortless gift, but there's a lot of different voices that each singer has. And I think every singer can do a lot of different things. And before with other producers, I had been told, raise the key, push harder. And I never really enjoyed that in the studio. I'm not this big, I love Carrie Underwood. I think she's a fantastic singer, but I don't sing that way. I like singing like Patsy Cline and in a lower register and very soft. But I didn't think that I was allowed to do that because everybody was telling me to do something different. But as soon as I started working with Dan Auerbach and Dave Brainerd, I remember Dan first, he said, hey, let's lower this key a half step. And I just want you to sing really soft. Just sing really soft and easy. Do what comes the most natural and the easiest to you. And
Wow.
that just blew my mind. And at first I thought, this guy's crazy. I was like, hey, what? This is gonna sound terrible. And it did not. And it was just the first time that I heard myself sing that way back to myself in the control room. I was like, whoa, wow. I didn't know that, one, that I could do that, and that I was
Yeah.
allowed to do that. And that was the moment I found my voice for sure. And Dave Brainerd really fostered that.
So for folks, Dave Brainerd produced the album. He's worked with Jamie Johnson, Brandi Clark, and then sort of someone on the rock and roll side, but a less familiar name to folks. Dan Auerbach, very familiar name, Black Keys, and rock star who has settled in as kind of the Owen Bradley of the new Nashville in many ways, a remarkable producer and is tapping talent, older and younger talent, and kind of putting them almost his Easy Eye world, his production operation and label. Feels like a kind of, for younger artists, a kind of higher education and a little bit of church all combined. Like that there's a spiritual thing that goes on and a practical learning development thing. And he does it by co-writing. So he's a co-writer on many of the tracks on Real Me. How'd you meet him? When did that relationship start?
After I left Spirit, I was just going through a lot of things. I had decided to leave, which made me jobless. And then I was going through a divorce, and it was kind of that call of desperation to somebody I hadn't talked to in, since I moved to town. So probably 8 years. And I called this guy, Dub Cornette. I don't know if you know him, but,
I definitely do.
He was the first person I met in Nashville that got me introduced to some people, that got me co-writing. I love him, but I just called him. I was like, oh my God, is this the moment I move back to Kentucky? Do I, like, what am I supposed to do now? Like, everything that I've worked for is over. Is it over? And he took me to lunch at Nashville, which is the most Nashville story in the world. and he was like, are you doing anything today? And I said, no. And he made a phone call. And he just sat back in his chair grinning at me on this phone call, like he knew something that I didn't know. I'm, you know, desperate and like, what am I doing here? And he took me to the butcher shop to meet David Ferguson. And we talked for a while, and then this is the first time I'd ever met David. And he was like, hey, well, why don't you just hop in my car? I'm going to take you somewhere. And I'm like, well, sure, I'll hop in this stranger's car, whatever. Probably not safe, but that's okay. And he took me to meet Dan. And within a few weeks, we were writing together. So, yeah, a really Nashville story.
Tell me about one or two songs on Real Me that feel like they were catalyzed and found a new direction for you, or something at least felt like that works with Dan. I have my own guesses, and I'd be curious if your answers are the same as mine.
Man, all those songs, we wrote those songs in 2 days. Yeah, I've never, like in all my years in Nashville and writing, I'd never done that before. We would write 4 songs a day. So in the 2 days we wrote 8 songs, and I cut 5 of those songs. And it was such a whirlwind that I don't even remember which song comes first, which one we wrote first. And it was such a different direction than anything I thought was ever possible for myself, or that I was like allowed to do. It wasn't something that kind of snapped really quick. It was, you know, over the next month of listening and re-listening to these songs, that I'm like, oh my gosh, this is what I was supposed to be doing this whole time. And I think, oh gosh, probably Broken Heart Breaks and Raggedy Heart were just that moment of, this is how I want to sing and this is how I want to write.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, the variety here is so striking to have those songs, many of them clustered in a short amount of time. But what I want to dwell on is that you've got an opening track that evokes Bobby Gentry, and it's humid and southern and string laden and laid back. You've got some fairly straight country ballads. You've got Wagon, which is this cool bounce and a very unique feel. And when you spoke to suddenly feeling liberated, I didn't know I could write this way or sing this way in Nashville, I assume you mean in contrast to the fairly businesslike music row trajectory, education you get at MTSU, the internships on the row, the commerce of trying to get songs on the radio, which in the time you were doing it were very male skewing. The women, like you said, like Carrie Underwood, were singing like divas. That subtle nuance, that soft, close microphone in your ear kind of quality, I haven't heard it on country radio in years, and that's what I miss there. So I get it from other places. That's just me talking, but how do you react to all that?
Yeah, I miss that too. And it's funny that one thing I heard over and over again from people on Music Row was like, you have to be an individual and you have to stand out. But then you'd stand out too much and they'd say, well, why don't you sound more like this? And I'm like, I thought you wanted me to sound different. And I'll never forget I wrote a waltz and turned it in. And everybody emailed back right away, and I was like, oh wow, a response. You know, you write so many songs, you never get a response, and you're just like, okay, well, that one's dead in the water. So, but everybody at the company emailed me back, and but all the responses were, man, I love this. Too bad it's not 1967. And I was just like, daggone it. Like, why can't we do this again? I love a good waltz.
Yeah, well, that's a whole ball of wax that I've been thinking about and studying in this town for a long time, and wouldn't still be here if there weren't the beautiful undergrowth and the meadows between the forest and the stuff where, you know, where the good stuff gets done. And as a Kentucky native, what's so striking, not me, you, that Kentucky is on fire again in country music. And it's just been the dominant kind of new wave in the last 5 and 6 years. Kelsey Walden, Sturgill Simpson, Tyler Childers, etc., picking up on this legendary, important legacy. What's going on in your mind? What do you think's been fermenting, and why is it catching fire in the roots Americana side of the world?
Well, probably because commercial music has not embraced it like they should, and I wish and hope that they will. I really hope that, you know, country music, commercial country music, turns around like it did in the 90s, where you had, you know, Ricky Skaggs and Patti Loveless coming from the more bluegrass side of the world and transitioning into country. And they made country music in the 90s. I mean, that was the sound. And I hope that radio will come, you know, that mainstream commercial radio will come back around on that. But I also hope that in the process of everybody hoping that that happens, that nobody shifts what they're doing, because it's not worth it. It's not worth it for Tyler or Chris, which I don't think they'll ever do, to switch their sound and try to fit this. Like, we all just need to hold our ground and say, hey, if you want to come and fit what I'm doing, cool. But if not, I'm going to be here doing my thing.
And it is, it's working commercially as well as critically. Is for the first time I can really look at these a number of Kentucky artists, and then of course everything from the Avett Brothers to Jason Isbell selling out big venues. And so, you know, the tide has turned in that respect, and it's really been fun and kind of like a little I told you so for all of us who stuck to wanting to hear real country music. You alluded to your divorce. You definitely went through a stretch of years, loss of feeling the ground shifted from under your feet, and in a sense, did that affect your feeling about interpreting music, about the way you sang, just in terms of grappling with some of life's trials? You turned one Great Married Again as a sort of saucy divorce song, and it's celebratory and funny and cathartic, I'm sure. It's a sing along, and it's a great track. But I mean, you know, a little bit of blues in your life can't hurt in the larger arc, right?
Yeah, I needed it. I needed that change. I think that I've always had everything laid out exactly how I've wanted it, and I've had tunnel vision to what I've wanted, and not really looked around. And then I got everything that I wanted. I got the publishing deal, and the marriage, and everything I thought that I wanted, and it was awful. I was writing music I didn't want to write. I was with somebody who I had nothing in common with, who didn't love me. But I needed to go through all of that so that I could know what I really wanted. Because I don't think that you can't know what you want until you know what you don't want. So it was just a huge, huge shift in absolutely every aspect of my life. And it changed me for the better.
Well, then a great way to wrap this up is to ask about the moment that the title track Real Me crystallized for you, and why it became a title track, and, you know, how that, where in this journey that light came on.
I think that after, you know, hitting my all-time low, I was tired of trying to be what I thought I was supposed to be and what I thought everybody else wanted me to be. And I was just finished with that. I was ready to play music that I wanted to play. I was ready to be in a relationship that I wanted to be in with somebody I had things in common with. And when Dave and I were recording, I was just sitting there, and he was like, what are we going to call this? I'm like, I think that Real Me is the title of this record because it is truly the real me. Like, I finally know who I am and what I want out of this life. And Dave was just like, oh my God, yeah, that you're exactly right.
Well, sounds like a good launch for the next decade or so, and congratulations. And I can't wait to keep reporting on you and listening to more music. This is a great start.
Thank you.